Good afternoon, I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for joining me for the 32nd edition of New Mainers Speak. This is a weekly half-hour program where you can hear firsthand about the lives of some of Maine's immigrants. During the show, we will visit with individuals regarding their life stories and enduring hopes as new Mainers. Today, my guest is Georges Boudagou, who lives in Portland, Maine. Born in an isolated village comprised of 10 small houses built on dirt floors in exceedingly rural DR Congo. He has lived a journey shaped by war. It took him through Rwanda and eventually brought him to the U.S. in 2002. Georges became a citizen in 2011. He's now an award-winning property manager for Avesta Housing, an author of an insightful memoir called Ladder to the Moon, has a lovely wife, Lise, and is the father of their six-year-old son named A.L. and their daughter, Ais, who just turned two. Welcome to New Mainers Speak, Georges.
Thank you very much, Kate, for having me here.
It's such a pleasure on this beautiful day.
Absolutely, yes. So can you enjoy the last piece of summer?
I think maybe the very last. What can you tell us about your serene and restful memories of your early life in your isolated village in the southern Kivu province of eastern DRC?
It's a beautiful area in terms of landscaping. Very beautiful. Surrounded by forests and very quiet. Very serene. And the only sounds that you hear there, it's sounds of animals in the forest, but also sounds of people calling each other because there's no cell phone, there's no phones there, there's no vehicle, there's no waterway, there's no trains. And rarely you will see airplane flying over the village. But the quietness of the village was just unbelievable. That's something I'm missing even now.
Yes, I bet it is. We don't have much quiet.
No.
I even notice it when I close the windows of my house hums. And it's all electric and glows too.
Yes,
I would miss that too. Yeah. I loved your book, Ladder to the Moon.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. And how you carefully described your family's daily chores as well as tribal rituals. You covered a lot of ground. Food preparation, gender-specific chores, weddings. And you have lived in two totally different worlds. I wonder, how do you reconcile all that is different between your original home with the silence and the beauty and your reality here in Maine?
It's challenging to reconcile two environments totally different. But I have learned to realize where I am now, knowing that I've already passed my old life and I move on with my new life. But I have to say that I still miss my village, the quietness, but also knowing that you lived in an environment which was not polluted. Because here, you know, all the carbon monoxide that is emitted every time, it's not safe. And I know that people are getting concerned with it. But I've learned to move on with my current situation. And that's how I've learned how to reconcile both situations.
But you can dream in Kivu.
Oh, yes, I always do that. And I always wonder why I'm still dreaming. Somewhere that I've lived 20 years ago, 30 years ago. It's just amazing how our memory can keep some of the memoirs back in our mind and bring them in our dreams. It's just amazing the way...
It is.
Yes, really amazing.
They're just gray cells, right? Mm-hmm. Brains by themselves look like nothing, but yet they can harbor smells.
Yes.
And how it felt to be there.
Oh, yes. Even, you know, like it's funny that sometimes you just smell something. And if you're going somewhere and here and you smell something, it just brings you back many years back in the village. Something that smelled the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And you just recall everything, where you were at that time and everything.
In chapter 2 of your book, you say that your grandmother often yelled at you saying, "That water you're drinking will kill you." That statement alone just amazes me. But that was your reality. And can you tell us what you drank instead?
We drank milk all the time. And it was our favorite drink. And it was a belief that if you drink water, it's a sign of poverty. It means that you don't have any cow. So, but also I didn't know at that time that I truly believe that if you drink a lot of water, you can probably die from it. Because my mother always warned me to not drink water, and especially in a dry season where there were not many milk. I don't want that much milk. So, but I didn't realize, I didn't know that our body composed with 60% of our body is with the water. So, and it's needed in our body. But then I believed that the drinking water was not safe. It was
perhaps healthy. They were exactly right. You know, if there was Giardia in the water or other parasites,
right. that's
you could get diarrhea and you would just die. There was no road to take you to a hospital.
Absolutely. That was another thing. But we drank milk all the time and I loved it. And, I loved it.
I love that you knew those animals so personally and really cared for them.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, we knew our cows and we even named them. You know, each cow had a name and you called them by name and they knew you too. And just amazing to leave behind animals and be with them in a field for a long time. It's like sometimes we spend hours and hours in the field with them. Just, you know, it's like you're talking to them. It's amazing the way you felt not alone with the cows.
I think of the kind of silence you knew and the kind of peace and the healthy foods you were eating. And you had said at one point in the book that you would go meditate out there on things you'd learned at church. And it was transformational.
Absolutely.
And I imagine it really was. You were in a perfect situation to kind of go up Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? You can move on to the spiritual because all your needs were met.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, absolutely. You know, it's the environment was so safe, and also, rarely you saw people getting sick, and I'm still wondering. I always wonder why, and I don't recall any for years you go without seeing anybody getting sick. Maybe it has to do with the purity of the environment because there was no pollution and everything, but when people got sick, they never go to hospital. They would stay home for one day or two, and get healed. So it's amazing that the environment had the healing power by itself. But also we believed in God, and we believe that if someone is sick, you pray for them and they get sick. They get healed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's also another piece that we did not rely on technology and hospital here, like people here. Every time you feel like sick, you go to hospital and then you panic. People never get to panic when they got sick. It's just they believe that, you know, this is temporarily, it's going to go away after 2 or 3 days, and they were fine after 3 days, indeed.
You believed in ancient wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
I bet it was it the women in the community that knew about the herbs and healing?
Yes.
And properties of things?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it was just an amazing area.
So what do you think of everybody getting sick here?
It's just, I don't know what's going on here, but it's different that I see people getting sick with the different types of diseases and cancer and all other types of sickness. It's just so. But even though there's a technology, and it's good that they have a technology that can cure some of the diseases, but they still get sick a lot more compared to back then in Congo when we lived in my village.
That's fascinating, isn't it?
It is fascinating, yes.
Your understanding of the natural world that completely enveloped your tribe where you grew up was profound. And you must sometimes long for that sky and those streams and cattle and the silence and total darkness that probably existed in the world of only footpaths. Are there skills that you learned living on the land that you apply to your life now, even though it's such a different life?
Oh, yes. Resilience is one of them. Because when you out walking, you know, trying to grow cows and everything, you work hard sometimes, and you learn that you have to make it, no matter what conditions you're facing. So I've brought here resiliency, but also the gratitude, being thankful for what you have now. And I like the saying here, they always say it could be worse. When you're facing a situation, you say probably things could be worse. That's just reminding you that this is temporary, but also it could have been worse. So you just reminding you that you have to be grateful, even though things are not fine or they are going in a way that you did not expect it. So I've brought that here and being thankful, and I really appreciate that. I have learned way in the beginning that you have situations will be always challenging sometimes, but you have to learn that this is temporary, it's going to pass, and then you're going to move to the next level of life.
You're listening to WMPG, Southern Maine Community Radio, broadcasting from USM. I'm Kate Manahan, and this is New Mainer Speak. If you're just joining us, welcome. Today I'm visiting with Georges Boudagou, originally from a very rural region of eastern DR Congo. He grew up as a member of the Banyamulenge tribe. This tribe historically stretched throughout the high plateau of the South Kivu region. When that area was later colonized, it was carved into different countries, Burundi, Rwanda, and Congo. However, his people made up a minority group that existed in each nation, a conflict formed as a result of the different ethnic and geopolitical boundaries, which gave rise to one of the most gruesome civil unrests of all time, which continues today. Georges, can you help us understand the extent of the destruction to your people?
It's just beyond what I can say in a few minutes. And if you look now, the scope of the conflict in the Congo has gone to a point where it's dramatic, and people have to pay attention to it to start bringing solutions, because it's been going on for many years now, and it doesn't seem that's going to change. And the way it started by the some discrimination of the Tutsi from Rwanda, and also the other thing that that inflamed the conflict was the aftermath of genocide in Rwanda, because if you read the history, you see that some of the Hutus who had already committed the genocide in Rwanda fled to Congo, and there were millions of them. They were armed, and they started also killing some of the Tutsis in the area, in the Congo. So that's how, in 1996, that the Rwanda decided to cross the border and they attack all the refugee camps of Hutu and Rwinteramo where they were around the borders. And that's how the conflict started in the Congo. And since then, in 1996 up to now, there hasn't been a peace in the Congo. There have been a series of killings and wars, and people are getting tired of it, and there are so many victims. And I don't know if people here know that over the last 17 years, more than 5.4 million people have died as a result of the conflict in the Congo. That's unbelievable.
And that's not just starving to death.
Yeah.
That's murders, right?
There's also starvation and the other diseases related to the fact that people have fled their village. They have no food. So they are dying with the hunger of starvation, but also malaria and the diarrhea. So it's everything included. And that's just beyond what people can think of. 5.4 million in just 17 years. It's like it's wiping up the population of Maine, New Hampshire, and Connecticut.
Wow.
Just in the 17 years.
It's
and the sad thing is that people do not know about it.
No.
If you go on the street here in Portland, you ask, do you know that for the last 17 years, more than 5.4 million people have died as a result of the conflict in the Congo? No one will know it.
No.
And it saddens me. And that was the purpose of writing my book, in fact.
And what's the response been to the book, Ladder to the Moon, A Journey from the Congo to America? What's that been like for you as an author?
It's been very healing when I started writing my book, but also the response that I'm getting now, it's just unbelievable. Everyone who've read my book have commented in saying that it's just an amazing book, and I think it is too, because the reason why I wrote my book was just to raise the awareness more than anything else. It wasn't about just me, but it was about the awareness of the conflict in the Congo. And for many years, I struggled on what I have to do while I'm here. And someone from Congo, what can you do if you're here? Can you just forget about the whole Congo and live a new life here in America now that I'm a U.S. citizen? But I realized that there's no way you can take away that part of your life. And that's where my roots are. And I realized I have to do something. And the one thing that I thought I could do is just raising the awareness. And that's what I've been doing now.
I think you're from a very resilient people. And from what I understand about this, the Banyamulenge were in Rwanda originally.
Lived in originally.
And then there was conflict there. They kind of migrated onto the plateau and raised their cattle there in peace. They just wanted to get away from the conflict.
Yeah.
Then there was conflict there, and they migrated kind of back to Rwanda. There was conflict there.
Yeah.
And a lot were put into camps.
Mm-hmm.
And so many Banyamulenge have come to the United States. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. Like, yes,
thousands and thousands.
What?
And I read online that Portland, Maine, is the hub of this.
Yes,
is this true?
It is true. It is true that the first Banyamulenge came here. I think it was in 1993. So after that, the many now, you know, they start coming, and they came. The other group of people came here in 1998, and in 2007. That's where we saw many Banyamulenge coming, and they were just surviving a massacre in Burundi, in a camp, a refugee camp in Burundi. So the U.S. was good enough to bring them here in the U.S. and give them safety. So we're talking about now thousands here in the U.S., and the majority are here in Maine, in Portland, Maine. So it's amazing, yes.
And do you have a strong community here?
Yes, we do have a strong community here in Portland, and we've been helping each other since every newcomer will try to help them in teaching them some of the skills that they need here, and also trying to be with them because some of them are suffering emotionally from the pains of a long suffering in back home. So we need kind of to be with them and tell them they are safe here, they can start new life, and that's been a very amazing process.
Do you offer these services and this being with people through Coco Maine? Or separately?
Churches. We do them separately. We have our own association. It's called Mahoro Maine Organization. And it's every state has a Mahoro, local Mahoro in every state. But from that organization, we do help them, the newcomers, and we try to be with them and help them in any way we can.
Hmm.
Yes.
That's really a significant...
But also churches. We also have churches that we can help people when they're coming here.
Do you have a sense of the numbers of people who are Banyamulenge in Portland, Maine?
It's the last time we were over 200, including
200.
Kids.
And that's the largest group?
Yeah, that's the largest group. But it's growing. And every year, at least, we see people coming from different camp in Africa. Recently, we got people from Kenya. We also people from Burundi. But they are going in different areas now. And, you know, here it's cold. People, if you from Africa... Men will probably not be your first choice.
That's why it's a little surprising that you have a hub here.
Yes, but they are now a huge group in Texas and Dallas and also Houston and also Arizona and Phoenix, but also in other areas. So they are going everywhere now.
I see.
Yeah.
I will post the links to your book and also to this group. Say again the name.
Mahoro Maine.
Mahoro Maine.
Yes.
Okay. And on my website, and you can look on the resources page for that. But how might interested people learn more and become involved about bringing change in DR Congo and surrounding regions?
That's a very good question. And I have two ways that I'm thinking is the best way to approach the conflict in Congo. First one is to do our best so that the current government can change in a positive way. And when I say changing, it's changing and giving some of the basic rights to the population. And that's something that has been now happening in Congo. And the way we can do that, like here in the U.S., we know that the U.S. is a powerful country. They are more influential everywhere in the world. So if we push our government leaders to influence Congo leaders to change and to the benefit of the population. And that's something that we can do by calling our senators, our congressmen, but also the president, if any way we can. But the other thing is that the media has been very silent toward the conflict in the Congo. I like news and I watch them every day. I never seen CNN, all the big TV channels, broadcasting the conflict in the Congo. And you wonder why. If you know that there's area where 5.4 million people have died, you would think the world would be alerted and do something about it. But they are silent. So I hope the media can come to a point of realizing that they need to raise the awareness of the conflict in the Congo. That's one way. The second way is by providing relief to the population that's suffering right now, including medical supplies, but also food. And if we can do that, do you know that I think the rest numbers were like there are 2.6 million refugees, like internal refugees. There are people who have been displaced from their home, living in a camp in the Congo. But they're also external refugees living in Rwanda, Burundi, and Uganda, and Kenya, and everywhere. Those are people who are living in the camps. They need also assistance in terms of food, but also medical supplies. So that's another way that anybody can contribute to that point.
Hmm, thank you for those points. I think those are all very, very valid ways.
And I know the first one may be difficult. It may take a long time because, you know, the people in the power holds the power for a long time. And I've written that in my book saying that if whoever is into the power, try to be there for a very long time, and unless they either kill him or they remove him. Otherwise, they tend to be there. And it may be the hardest part to influence them to change. But we can do our best in changing them. But also supplying the food and the medical supplies, it's easy. There's something anybody can do.
Yes, the real help today.
Yes.
And then plan for longer term.
Yes, absolutely.
I love that. Mm. I wondered if there's any part of your book that you would be interested in pointing out for us, reading us a couple pages.
Oh, I don't know. I can.
Do you have a favorite part that you like to read at readings?
I have the 39 chapter.
Okay.
If I can read that. And that's the memory of when I got my U.S. citizenship here.
I love that.
So I can just read a couple paragraphs. On November 18th, 2011, I sat in the Federal District Courtroom in Portland, Maine, and wait to take the last step in a very long journey, being sworn in for my U.S. citizenship. The night before the ceremony was long and tiring. I had to work an overnight shift, covering for one of my colleagues at my second job, and I was filled with anxious anticipation. I was looking forward to seeing how the special day was going to unfold, and in my excitement, I could not rest my mind. I spent the entire night thinking about the ceremony. I had difficulty believing that after nearly 10 years, I was finally going to be an American citizen. In the morning around 7 a.m., I finished work, went home, and started getting ready. It was early still, but I could not hold myself at home to wait until 9:30, which was the arrival time for the ceremony. I took a long shower and refreshed my mind from my long night of work. Then I put on my suit and drove out to the courthouse building. I arrived around 8:30 a.m. and had to wait in my vehicle for a little while. I was very anxious and just wanted to get into the building and wait there. At 9:30 a.m., I finally walked into the building and stood at the check-in station where two gentlemen welcomed me with warm congratulations before allowing me inside. This time was different from previous experiences. When I first started my immigration process 10 years ago, it was very intimidating and confusing. There were many of us going through the checking point at the same time and thereafter heading upstairs into the courtroom. The footsteps of new citizens followed by their family members who had come to celebrate with them echoed throughout the hallway. You could see the excitement on the face of every individual who walked into the building, and it felt like a graduation ceremony. After checking in, I went upstairs to the second floor and presented my document. I then had to complete a questionnaire. Finally, they handed to me a folder with a bunch of documents that I had to take with me into the courtroom. In exchange, I gave away the green card that I had been carrying in my wallet for 5 years. At last, I walked inside the courtroom and sat down comfortably while waiting for the ceremony to start. The courtroom was beautiful and inspiring, and as I looked around, I was carried into deep thoughts. My reflection took me away back to my tiny village in the Congo where I was born. I began to weep. I realized what a long road I had traveled alone and what terrifying and erroneous steps I've made since leaving my village in the U.S., my village in the Congo. I contemplated how this long journey brought me to the U.S., far from the region where I was raised and where I imagined I would grow up and eventually decline in age. I kept looking at the high and beautiful ceiling ornamented with amazing architectural and decorative details that enhanced its structural beauty. There were so many paintings and pictures hanging on the walls of great men and women of American history. This made me marvel over the greatness of the United States of America. I think I can stop right there.
Thank you. I think that gives people a lovely sample of how rich and powerful your book is.
Oh, thank you.
I thank you very much for leading me through that whole process. I fell in love with where you grew up, a subsistence life with no cash, cars. And then your transformation as you became a student in the local city, mm-hmm. and then a student of the world and a citizen of this country.
Yes.
It's an amazing journey,
I think, yes,
George.
It is an amazing journey, yes. I'm grateful that, God have kept me to this point. And maybe there's a reason why I'm still here, because my friends, many of my friends that we played together are no longer there. So if I'm here today, it has to be a good reason. And that's why I'm advocating for those who cannot say anything for themselves.
That's beautiful and really important. Yeah. While reading your book, my heart broke for all the loss you've experienced individually and as a people.
Yeah.
And you've miraculously rebounded time and again. And I wanted to ask you one last question about what made you so resilient? Do you think that there's a connection between gratitude and resilience?
Oh, yes. If I can say the resilience, there's so many things that can fuel the resiliency. And one of them, and the major one, I think, to my belief, is the hope. The hope of knowing that there's a light at the end of the tunnel. It's very helpful. Knowing that this, every situation is temporary. Nothing will last forever. The other thing is also gratitude. Knowing that being thankful for what you have first. Knowing that it could be worse.
I love that. George, you wrote Ladder to the Moon to help raise awareness about the horrible ongoing conflict in DRC. I know that you had considered a career in conflict resolution at one point, and I think your book supports that goal. It is a significant offering that will help people understand the scope of what's going on in your country of origin. My hope is that understanding is a step toward resolution in and of itself. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to thank you for coming on the show today and sharing some of these difficult stories.
Absolutely. Thank you, Kate, for having me. I appreciate your invitation.
I'm Kate Manahan in the studio with my guest, George Boudagou. You've been listening to New Mainers Speak. We will close today's program with some music that George has selected for us. Can you tell us a little bit about this song, George?
The song is it's called The Number One, and this is the song for my nephew. He's just a talented young man. I can't believe it. And I didn't know that he was a musician until I saw this CD. He emailed me. He lives in India right now. He's a student and he's doing pharmacy. And when he emailed me saying, I'm about to produce a CD and I would like you to support me. And I said, what kind of CD are you producing? And he said that it was Christian songs that he's going to produce. And this one, he called it Number One. We believe in God through Jesus Christ of salvation. And we believe that we survived because of him. And that's why he called it that Jesus is number one. And I really love the song. And I hope you can enjoy it too.
Thank you. And your nephew's name is?
Israel Mbonyi.
Israel's song, Number One, up next. Thanks for joining us.
Uri number one. Uri wambere. Uri number one. Uri wambere. Abagabo bararutanye narabibonye. Mu minsi itatu gusa Satani arayamanika. Isi y'umwijima yose ihinda umushyitsi barabazanya. kwisimana twabanya nawe imfura zo kwisiko ntacyo zitumarira abo twita bakomeye ntacyo wadufasha uri number one hagati y'amabuye niho wanyubakiye ndashikamye